This is Juliette Kayyem with the Security Mom Podcast, brought to you by WGBH News. I don't really know how to explain this summer. I feel like there's a banner headline every day. And in just the few days that I have been on the road, you know, we went from the Nice terrorist attack to the attempted coup in Turkey to dead policemen in Baton Rouge. And it's overwhelming. It's even overwhelming for me. And we try to keep pace of these changing times and changing news and these big stories with this podcast. Sometimes it's easy and sometimes it's not so easy. But I do also think it's important that while someone like me can always chase the headlines because there's always going to be a headline, that sometimes my responsibility is also to explain the big picture. So just a few weeks back, when it seemed like maybe this was going to be the story of the time, I got to sit down with Ambassador Wendy Sherman. Many of you will remember her name. She was one of the lead negotiators in the Iran deal. And we just talked about simply what that deal was about and why is it raising so much concern and what was the process of coming to a diplomatic deal. It seems more relevant today for two reasons. One is clearly, just as we are in this political season, the Iran deal has become a focal point for critics of the Obama administration and critics, of course, of Hillary Clinton, but also a focal point for those who want to applaud diplomacy in an age when everything seems to not be working by those standards. I also wanted a chance to have a woman speak about these big issues. Too many times, you know, it's the men who get up on stage or at the conventions who talk about war and fixing problems and nuclear issues. Wendy Sherman is a woman who took the lead with Secretary John Kerry in trying to come to a diplomatic solution to a challenge that has plagued us for a long time, and that is the Iranian-U.S. relations. So I wanted to begin with the basics, which is, what is the Iranian deal?
So most Americans think about Iran, and they think about, you know, all of the Americans that were taken hostage in 1979, but the enmity, the lack of trust between our countries actually started back in the 1950s when we were part of an intelligence operation to depose the prime minister of Iran after he nationalized the oil industry, and our British colleagues weren't particularly happy about that. So it's long held and pretty fierce, and we've all gone and seen Argo, so yeah, we know what this is all about. And in fact, there have been negotiations that have gone on all through the Obama administration and before the Obama administration to try to ensure that Iran's ostensibly peaceful nuclear program wouldn't be used to make the material necessary to make a nuclear bomb. And nobody was quite sure whether, in fact, they weren't trying to get a nuclear bomb. But then, in 2013, there was a change in Iran. There was a new president of Iran, Ahmadinejad, which I think some of your listeners heard about because he was so outrageous and so extreme in his hatred for America and for our ally Israel, was voted out. And Rouhani came in as president. He actually had been one of the earlier negotiators in the nuclear negotiations. And Rouhani, you know, I don't know that I'd call him a moderate. I sort of talk about there are hardliners in Iran and hardliners. On the Iranian scale of things, he is more moderate, though a conservative cleric. And he understood that Iran's economy, which was deep in the hole, was never going to get better unless he could get the sanctions lifted that had been put in place by the United States, but also by the entire international community and enforced by the international community. So Iran was deep in the hole. And when that election happened, there was a bit of an uprising in Iran, which was pushed down pretty quickly. But it made Rouhani understand that more than half of the population's under the age of 30. If they didn't see a future, well, who knew what was going to happen and whether the regime would sustain itself. So he got serious about this negotiation. So that was one piece. Second piece was Barack Obama. Yeah. The president of the United States saw an opportunity to ensure that Iran would never, ever obtain a nuclear weapon. And he had the political will and took some very courageous decisions and asked first for there to be a secret negotiation that went on that was brought into this multilateral negotiation and ultimately over a two-year period achieved an agreement.
And in the intensity of those moments when you're really negotiating the different waves of negotiation, I think people would be very curious. Do you just get a phone call like, okay, you just got to move out to Vienna and deal with this? I mean, how do you even structure how something like that is going to unfold when you don't even know if you can get to the end game? Because presumably there were times you were like, we're done, it's not going to happen.
There were many times when we thought this is done, it's not going to happen. Remember, we were having bilateral discussions, but also multilateral discussions with all of the permanent members of the Security Council, that is the United Kingdom, France, Russia, China, the United States, and Germany, plus the European Union, which coordinated this effort and did a lot of the negotiating as well. So there were many times when we all, for the first year, a lot of what we were doing is just seeing where everybody else was, what they were willing to put on the table, brainstorm ideas. We had a core team of about 15, but we were backed up by literally hundreds of people in our government. Whenever we had an idea, it went out to our nuclear labs for validation. Each one of the countries had its own team of experts, and we negotiated with other people as well. So I joke all the time that we negotiated inside the U.S. government because you have to agree among departments and agencies what your policy is going to be, what your trade space is going to be, what you're going to agree to, what you won't agree to. Then we, of course, had consultations and negotiations with the U.S. Congress. We had negotiations bilaterally and as a group with each of our negotiating partners. We had negotiations with Israel. We had negotiations with the Gulf Arab states. We had negotiations with countries like Japan and Korea, which imported a lot of Iranian oil, and anybody else who was interested. And then occasionally we negotiated with Iran.
Right.
So very complicated negotiations. And so the reason that I led the team is because the Undersecretary for Political Affairs in the U.S. government is the political director of our country. And the negotiation was done at the level of political director.
Yeah.
So that's why I was in the room working with all of my colleagues all of the time. There were times we would meet in Vienna or Geneva for a few days, then we'd go back for consultations with our own government, then come back again. When Ahmadinejad was president, the negotiations were held in Farsi and English. And we would jet all over the world. We went to Almaty. We went to Baghdad for one of the negotiations. It was all for naught. It never went anywhere because Ahmadinejad didn't want it to go anywhere. Then when Rouhani became president, we started negotiations. We did most of them in either Geneva and then ultimately the vast majority in Vienna. When you get to the places where you've got to take a big step, you've got to stay for as long as it takes. So the last round of the negotiations, I spent 27 days in a hotel in Vienna.
You had a big job anyway.
I mean,
you just sort of that this, but then this became maybe just a legacy for the Obama administration. It was going to show that you could negotiate with quote unquote enemies or people who, as you say, you
total
know,
mistrust. Are,
yes.
Total
and,
mistrust.
But come to a common solution that they have a reason for doing it and we have a reason for doing it. That in that month that you were there, can you just explain to us sort of, are you socializing with this? I think people are curious.
Right,
like
sure.
You're like, there's a hotel room and there's reporters.
Sure. And remember,
are you working out?
Secretary John Kerry, working out, climbing up and down stairs. Secretary John Kerry spent, I think, 2.5 weeks at the negotiations in Vienna, the longest a Secretary of State has ever stayed in one place. Now, he had a broken femur, which made it hard for him to move around. But nonetheless, he stayed. He also had a big job.
Yeah.
So we have modern means and secure technology. He could be on the telephone. He could do a secure video conference. He could interact with other ministers who came to be part of the negotiations as well. So he could keep doing his job. And I did the same thing. I was responsible for every region in the world and all the assistant secretaries. And I had a staff person with me whose major job was to give me reports of what else was going on in the world so I knew what else I had to do. So for those 27 days, though, most of my time was spent on this negotiation. You'd get up early in the morning. Probably most of us had breakfast in our room because you're trying to multitask and read the newspapers and get ready. Some folks were able, because of means they had, to catch up on intelligence they needed to know, have an early morning staff meeting so everybody knew what was to be done because people worked in different groups on different problems, different groups of experts with different partners. Then there might be some downtime during the day when you could take care of other things while other groups were working on another part of the negotiation. Usually these would go late into the night, and towards the end you get almost no sleep at all. You use a lot of woolite.
I am sure woolite is only one of many solutions to the challenges of negotiating a deal with Iran, but it does give you a sense of what it's like to be in those rooms. But hopefully it also gives a better sense of what it means to be a diplomat in this day and age. I've often wondered, is there even a role for diplomacy when we tend to talk about war or intelligence or surveillance or even law enforcement efforts? It seems so antiquated and out of date in a world of Twitter and Facebook, but the diplomatic community is not immune to these changes. And Ambassador Sherman definitely has some serious thoughts on this. It was unusual, to say the least, to have 47 senators send a letter to the country we are trying to negotiate a deal with saying, we don't support it, and if we win the presidency, this isn't going through. Unusual is a euphemism. It was outrageous. Foreign policy is always negotiated by a president, whether it is President Trump, President Clinton, or someone else. And for the U.S. senators to get out there and do this not only showed their antagonism towards President Obama and what he was trying to do with the Iranian deal, but I think for the institution of the presidency itself.
And so the Iranians, of course, said, you know, you can't guarantee us you can follow through on this deal because we got this letter from the U.S. Senate. And you have to explain how our system works, what a democracy is, that a deal is only as good as the content of the deal. If it's a good deal, it will survive. If it's not, it won't. So we used that outside pressure, even though we didn't think the letter was a particularly good idea, to say, look, we've got a tough situation, so you're going to have to give us a lot in order for us to sustain this.
I had to think that this takes a tremendous toll on the people in the room. I mean, there were pictures coming out of the room, tweets, tremendous pressure, part of the presidential campaign. And all they're trying to do is get a deal that is going to hold between two parties that have essentially not spoken to each other for decades. It's got to be hard and trying as a personal and physical issue. And that wasn't lost on Wendy Sherman.
And one of the team members' kids, because this is very hard on families, yeah, sent us all sock puppets, made a sock puppet for each one of us. We'd share videos of our kids and our grandkids. And my favorite story on myself is I had a fairly young grandson, and my daughter would send me photos or videos at the end of each day, which sustained me, quite frankly. And she sent me one where he is looking at the front page of the New York Times, and it has a picture of me on it sitting with Secretary Kerry, and he kissed the newspaper.
Aww.
And that sort of like did me in. But also, you know, it made me think I'm doing this so the world is safer, more peaceful. We certainly got to know the Iranians. We were focused on two things, the nuclear negotiation and our American citizens. And I had a separate bilateral negotiation that went on about getting our American citizens home. And they finally have come home. Not all of them still really want to find out where Bob Levinson is and bring him home. My Iranian counterpart and I both became grandparents during this negotiation. So we'd share videos of our grandkids, and then we'd go right back in the negotiation room and be as difficult with each other as we needed to be.
Right. So the public deal is obviously important because you need not only approval over here, but you have such a interesting mix of other countries that all need to agree to the public document. But the second it came out, the critics of it were critical of the deal itself, but also the prisoner issue. And yet anyone who had been in government knew there's got to be a bigger story here.
Well, you know, you've been in government and around this business long enough to know that you can't say everything you know.
Right.
I can't say everything I know today.
I know.
You just have to keep your eye on what you're trying to achieve and know that the truth will ultimately come out. It is a very consequential responsibility that is on the president, that's on the Secretary of State, Secretary Moniz, who was so key to this, and a team of people whose names nobody will ever know, who, quite frankly, you know, the president, Secretary Moni, Secretary Kerry, and I have the most visible face. Mm-hmm. But my goodness, the people who work night and day on this, all the technical details, all the scientific work that had to be done, I certainly can't do that.
So you've had the most amazing career. And I mean, I respect
an unexpected
people.
Unexpected life.
Yes, the sort of nonlinear professional career. And I guess you didn't start as an Iranian expert, right? But now you've spent so much time. And I think hearing from you, you know, if you could imagine Iran in the next 10, 20, 30 years, do you have a sense that this moment of a little bit of opening for them into the world will change them?
I don't know. This deal was not done on the basis of trust. This deal was done on the basis of monitoring and verification and validation that they do and comply with what they're supposed to comply with, and so do all the partners. And if they don't comply, all of the options that we had, all of which were not so hot, imposed more sanctions. And people should know the sanctions never stopped their nuclear program. It just got them to the negotiating table. But their nuclear program grew enormously over the years of the sanctions. So we can reimpose sanctions just by ourselves. Or we can, of course, take military action, which would set their program back, but only by 2 or 3 years probably. And then they'd go underground and try to do it secretly so we couldn't bomb them again. So all of our options will still remain. This is about compliance. They have so far complied with everything they're supposed to do. And it has opened a channel of communication. Secretary Kerry can call or email Javad Zarif, the foreign minister of Iran. Secretary Moniz can talk to Ali Salehi, who's head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, and solve problems. Obviously, when we had that horrible situation where Iran took our sailors, we got them back within 24 hours. They shouldn't have taken them, but we got them back within 24 hours, which is unheard of in these kind of situations. So we have a way to communicate, and we got most of our Americans home. And as I said earlier, half of the population's under 30. They don't want to be isolated from the world. They want what they see on YouTube.
Yeah.
Even though there's censorship, they get on YouTube. They get on Facebook. I'm hopeful, but I think the jury is out. It is still a revolutionary society. It is still a society that's led by very conservative clerics, by a supreme leader who isn't all supreme. There are politics in Iran. People tend to think of Iran as, you know, a monolith. It's not. But I don't know. I hope so, but I don't know.
You started off in sort of child welfare, child advocacy. You were part of an effort to do negotiations with North Korea. You've had the most remarkable career, your mother and a grandmother. And what was your attitude about your career? Like, how does it unfold like?
I tell students when I teach or when I talk to young people not to have a 5-year plan, because you'll miss great opportunities. What I do also say is get a skill set that's transferable. And my skill set was as a community organizer, as a social worker, as a clinician. That's what my master's degree is in. And I've teased over the years that my caseload has just changed. It went from child welfare in the state to American politics to the world. And a lot of what I learned, really starting where the other person is on the other side of the table, being able to see the whole landscape in front of you, which you have to do as an organizer, you have to see 360 degrees. Having courage of your convictions. I had folks who were very active in the civil rights movement. Actually, they were at the founding of the United Nations. So their activism goes way, way back. And they took big economic hits because of their courage. So have the courage of your convictions. Learn the skills and the substance you need, some competence. And then if you're lucky, you're at the right place at the right time.
Being at the right place at the right time, that may describe Wendy Sherman's career, but I also think it describes the moment we're in terms of relations with Iran. This may just be the right place at the right time. So over the course of this presidential campaign, when the Iranian deal comes up for debate, or Ben Rhodes' interview becomes the focus rather than the substance of the deal itself, just remember, All it was a bunch of people sitting around a table with their woolite and the pictures of their kids and grandkids, trying to bring two nations together, two nations that matter to each other, whether we like it or not. This is Juliette Kayan with the Security Mom Podcast. My producer is Catherine Whelan, and we are produced at WGBH News. Thanks for listening. You could download on iTunes and about everywhere else. And if you're interested, buy my new book, Security Mom, available on Amazon and just about everywhere else.